just bare our hearts before the Lord and celebrate. Before we jump into Malachi 2, verse 10 through 17, there's a refining of the American church that's going on at some level. There's a whole bunch of really smart, serious-minded people all kind of having this discussion and this dialogue and trying to identify why is the American church in the condition it is, and lots of really, really good voices that are speaking into that. And Jeff, some of the videos we've watched from Jeff Vanderstelt, Verge Network, and there's Gospel Coalition. There's just a number of people going, look, the fruit is not in keeping with what has been promised. So what do we need to do? What do we need to think? What do we need to identify? And so a lot of what we're trying to understand is how is this gospel formation, that idea of being in the gospel primer, washing ourselves with our gospel identity, is going to be a significant piece of that. But it's also letting ourselves be challenged in what we believe to be true, what we perceive to be reality. And the book of Malachi is one of those places where they had a very clear perspective on what was real and true, and it was wrong. And that's what the whole dialogue is. You think this, it ain't true. This is what's true. And unless you choose to turn around and say, no, this is true, you are going to suffer the consequences of that. You're going to miss the opportunity to be blessed by what actually is true, relationship with God. And so this is one of those little dialogues. And if most of you in the room have been through the marriage class where we talk about stress and the things that we take for granted. Because we're American, this is the way it should be. And in that conversation, I keep going, that's not true. Most of the things we put our life's blood and energy into are not kingdom things. Some of them are necessary work, etc., but even how much we work and for what and what do we have to accomplish day to day in order to be faithful disciples, to live a simple life in quiet godliness, what do we really need? What do our kids need? What do our relationships need in order to bring health and life, and that the gospel identity would really flow out? And there's all kinds of voices speaking into us, saying, this is true, this is what you deserve, this is normal, this matters, this doesn't matter, and a whole bunch of it is a bunch of hooey, and we have to have the courage to confront that and go, okay, wait a minute, I'm gonna decide to believe what's true based on what God says, based on the kingdom perspective. This will make you happy. Maybe, maybe not. God promises this is how we find joy and peace. And this video is just a little snippet. It's only 2 minutes long. Even before we start it, because some of you will react to it. Some of you go, that doesn't apply to me. Some of you think, well, that's just, you know, he doesn't understand. He's a pretty well-read, he's a very smart, very observant guy. On the grand scheme of, he's probably one of 100 guys that go, man, that guy's a clear thinker. Man, he sees clearly. From my perspective about what I've read, I don't agree with him in everything, but boy, do I respect his process for getting to his conclusions. He's a man who fears the Lord, and he's one of those macro-level thinkers that is in thousands of conversations, and I believe he's a spirit-filled man, and I would just encourage us just to take 10 seconds and go, Lord, if there's something in here for me, I pray I would be yielded, that I wouldn't immediately go into, oh, no, that's he's not talking to me. He's not talking to me. I believe what he said. I talk about what he said. And there's still stuff in there that go, oh, I'm not there yet. I'm swimming in this cultural soup, and it's shaping what I believe to be necessary. And I don't want to be there. I want to be firmly a man who lives in quiet godliness, sowing to the Spirit, investing in the kingdom. And everything else has to be distant second place, because if we leave it in close second place, then it'll take from us. We're too close to the action when we don't distance ourselves from it. We'll look at some of those things in Malachi as well, just how there's this fundamental shift in understanding about things that we have to manage. So, did you get it going yet? What's that? Excellent. So could you please turn off the two black switches behind you, the ones labeled black? Great, thanks. So this is also a lip reading exercise. Not going to get it? How do you guys respond to that? Any conviction? Any sense of, well, let me evaluate how this is going? What are you pointing at? Are you pointing at me? Do you need some? Okay. You're making me very self-conscious back there pointing up this direction. Yeah, I'm incredibly self-conscious, you can tell. Is there conviction there? We'll try to get that link. Aaron, if you wouldn't mind, I'll if you don't see it, a link, just put that in. You can watch it again as family. Discuss it. What? I love that question. I think if you've been paying attention, you've heard very similar words. Does your schedule, does your checkbook reflect your values? Say, this is what I believe to be true, and this is what I actually spend my time on, and this is what I actually spend my money on. When those are disconnected, there's going to be a lack of peace and a lack of joy and a lack of fruit in your life, how life flows out. And so just to be considering that.
Just a thought on that.
Yeah.
Yep. When I was over at the Lakota Hope last week for their board meeting,
yep.
There was a lady there, was like a regional director for the Association of Gospel Rescue Missions, and she asked them a question as they're having this board meeting that was maybe well-intentioned but a little bit dysfunctional.
Yeah, we're pressed into it by the culture, and we never really make a conscious choice. We may not make a conscious choice to embrace those other values. We don't have to, though. They press in on us. This becomes normalized. And why would I do anything different than what the culture is doing? We never stop and ask those hard questions. Just remember, just to remind you all, if you're feeling pressed in some of those things, that tool in the skills workbook on stress reduction, you can go through again and just walk through what's stressing us, what's creating stress, and then really start to walk through and put it in those grids and have that family conversation. Even for some of you high schoolers, you may think, wow, this is really overwhelming and I'm just feeling like this is too much. Well, what's really there, and is that the stuff you really want to be there? Is that what you would say at the end of my life, this is how I want to spend my late teens, this is how I want to spend my 20s, this is how I want to spend my 30s, this is how I want to spend my 40s. So at the end, I'm not disappointed that I just kind of got into this current, which is it is insanely busy if you aren't very disciplined. It does not mean having a full life is out of the will of God. It's just full with what? Is it relationship? Is it care? Is it kingdom-centered kind of things? You should have a full life, but not doing things that you'll regret investing in. So just wanted to tee that conversation up again. It is one of the first questions. Almost in every stage of life, we have to keep wrestling with. What's the very common, if you aim at nothing, you'll hit it every time. Every single time. 100% accurate when you have no plan. And you may land at something that you're filled with regret. I want to jump into Malachi 2 here briefly. We'll spend a lot of time on this section. The conversation, again, coming, remember, this is God asking questions, the people responding usually with a kind of, what? What do you mean? What are you talking about? And God's saying, really conveying, this is how it feels when you live this way. This is how it impacts my heart. This is, it's an incredibly relational book. Verse 10, Chris looked at, I didn't get all the way through his message. I don't know how it ended. I think I know. I read some of his notes. Hopefully I won't repeat something or we won't miss a gap here. We'll put our heads together when we get back together later this week and make sure we didn't miss any big points. But beginning in verse 10, reading out of the NLT, if you have that version, you can follow along. Are we not all children of the same Father? Are we not all created by the same God? Then why do we betray each other, violating the covenant of our ancestors? This is a really interesting question because of what follows. Because of the context of what follows. Because there's certain personal choices that we make and go, what's the big deal? How God receives that is when he says, this is what my people are going to look like. This is the standards for them. And someone chooses to behave differently. It's perceived as betrayal. It's not personal freedom. It's not living out your convictions. It's like you see this that way, I see that way. That's not what he says. If the standards are clear and we don't live according to them, it is a betrayal to this covenant that the people of God are supposed to be living in. And we're going to talk about the tithe later, but I remember years ago I took over the church finances in Ames. It was before I was a pastor. I wasn't even a deacon. And I'm not sure why they thought that was a good idea because I'm not really a detail guy. But I managed them for a while. And I think I brought some good and value to it. But I remember it was very shortly after starting to do that. And I may have shared this story with you before. Because I know the cost for our young family to be faithful to tithe. I know the tears we had to walk through, the battles we had to fight when we would go to our extended family and they're all driving new cars and buying new furniture on time and this whole lifestyle and having to call them. I don't know if you guys can envision Cindy as a young, fearful bride being manhandled by the gorilla of me, trying to shepherd her through these conversations, trying to bring faith, trying to help us walk in obedience. And you guys don't have a context. You didn't watch my kids grow up. You didn't watch our relationship develop. You didn't watch our faith grow over time. We didn't just land where we are. There's lots and lots of hard choices. And as we're making that decision to be faithfully tithing, and I still have the budget. I have our tax returns just because they're part of the altars I build. to say this God is faithful. So I hang on to all those things. Can't we shred this? No. I'm not a paper guy, but those, and I would be fine with a picture. We could digitalize it. But I want the record. I want to be able to look and track what God has done over time. And I remember having that conversation, and I was figuring out this custom computer program some men in the church had designed for our giving and our tracking database, membership database. It's a little tiny Mac screen. I don't know if you guys remember those little tiny computers. That's how old it was. It was just like, you know, this 8-inch screen and all these numbers and columns. And I remember, okay, we need to kick off a giving report. And I, okay, here we go. Let's kick this out. And I was just filled with joy, hope. And that was the single most devastating day of my entire Christian life, without question. And I've faced a lot of hard things. Without question, that was the most devastating moment. Because here's what I thought. I thought we were in this together. I thought I was not alone in this. I've never been more embarrassed. I worked at a job that, while I was doing some of those finances, where it was a monitoring. And so there were times where you could sit, you could read, you make rounds, but you weren't responsible to stare at screens 100% of the time. So I would take finances, my finances, church finances, and I would work on some of those little projects sitting at the desk, and I've never been more embarrassed. A completely dear man, I respect him, but completely not biblical worldview, functionally atheist, walked through, and I just happened to have, and he couldn't see names, he didn't know anybody, but he saw all the zeros and all the really, really small numbers. And I don't remember exactly what he said. Something along the lines of, whoa, you don't have very committed people, do you? A guy that doesn't even have the Spirit of God understood that there was a covenant. He was more generous with his golf country club. He understood it. This is mine. I'm going to participate in it. And he instantly saw the betrayal of covenanting together and say, this is not a small thing. This is a big thing. When we covenant together about what we invest in, what we give our energy to, what we give our emotion to, how we choose our standards for what's acceptable. And I'm not going to define all those things. We're not going to come up with a big list of to-dos. It's a heart thing. Am I mindful? Are the choices I'm making are going to impact you, your reputation, the reputation of us, which is the reputation of Jesus in our culture, matters in this betrayal. How my actions impact you motivate me. And we can think so small of that, and it gets into some big conversations, some big areas where they go, yeah, it probably doesn't matter. It's not a big deal. This covenant that God has called us to, this standard, and in the new covenant, it's not quite as defined. But there are some big principles. And then he goes on to say this in verse 11. Judah has been unfaithful, and a detestable thing has been done in Israel and in Jerusalem. The men of Judah have defiled the Lord's beloved sanctuary by marrying women who worship idols. May the Lord, this is strong call. I mean, this is a really strong thing to say. May the Lord cut off from the nation of Israel every last man who has done this and yet brings an offering to the Lord of heaven's armies. Because look, if you're gonna violate the standard, you lose the opportunity to even participate in worship. You have betrayed this standard. Now, that is not the exact same standard, though mapping over, there's very similar standards, but it's not quite as clear. And we can read this and go, that's racist. It's not racist. What he was trying to refine was not a racial purity. It was an affection purity. It was a covenant purity that you would marry people that saw the world the way you see them. And hang on to that phrase. See, that we would marry someone, that we would pursue someone and only someone. And I'm assuming just like then there are people in that context who wanted to be married that God hadn't provided a wife for. And maybe they were just prettier. I don't know. But it is a pretty human thing, and it can be devastating to want to be married and not have that fulfilled. We need to be careful with that. It's not a small thing. It is a huge pressure on the human experience, men and women. And yet the covenant was an acceptable option is not to join yourself who sees things, who worships, whose values are different than yours. They're not part of this covenant. They're not part of operating in God's grace and blessing and sacrificial system, and therefore they are off limits under any circumstance. And if you choose that, there's going to be, you lose the right to even offer sacrifices, which was, that was worship. We sing, they killed things, okay? That was their worship. It's not a small thing. Oh, no big deal, I don't have to give a ram. No. That was a big part of how they expressed faith, was these offering, bringing offerings. And here's another thing you do. I just love the relational language. You don't get this. You cover the Lord's altars with tears, weeping, groaning, because he pays no attention to your offerings and doesn't accept them with pleasure. You cry out, why doesn't the Lord accept my worship? And he gave a little hint in the passage right before that. Why doesn't the Lord accept my offer? I'll tell you why. Because the Lord witnessed the vows you and your wife made when you were young, but you have been unfaithful to her, though she remained your faithful partner, the wife of your marriage vows. Now, I don't know if this was, you know, visiting temple prostitute. I don't know how this was expressed, if this was full-blown adultery or just not really living in that Song of Solomon kind of delight and joy in our mate, or Proverbs 5 kind of idea of being disciplined and of guarding our cistern and not letting others attract us. Here's what I do know. If Jesus was redefining this in the new covenant, I'm pretty sure it would go to, it's your very affection for her. Because remember, commit adultery went from actually adultery to just lusting. In God's standard, it's always about the heart. We're unfaithful to that which God does provide in a godly way, and we treat it as a small thing. This is this incredibly high call that this relationship, there's a covenant. God is a God of covenants. When he gives his word, he gives his promise, he's covenanting. Sometimes it's conditional. It's based on our reactions and responses. Oftentimes it is not. He says, this is the way it's going to be. This is what I'm going to do. So when he says there's a covenant, you need to just take that and elevate it. Okay, this is significant. This is a contract. This is God saying, this must happen or I'm unhappy. This bothers me. And so often, even in that kind of planning, letting life get busy, letting our affections wane, even when it's affection for our kids and we neglect, you know, we have a greater affection and investment in making sure our kids have, you know, are entertained than we do in cultivating vital relationship and our marriage relationships. Or as those of you who are single or teens, that we entertain ourselves, that we have all these activities and we don't invest in these covenant relationships of oneness that are present in the church. Certainly he's talking about marriage, but remember the big idea of God is not to have great marriages. The big idea of God is that we would experience oneness as his people, regardless of your marital status. It's a covenant. We say, that's small, this is big. And that's not God's values. We put ourselves in this place, and so often our prayers are hindered. When we just don't guard our heart. We say, this is more important. And that can be entertainment, that can be activities, that can be music, that can be food, any number of things. Just staying busy. I mean, just staying busy. Even now, that would be my, just resting, being available, being emotionally ready. That's my challenge because I like to do. I don't like to rest. Doing is restful to me. Not doing is stressful. But there's this covenant that we all agree this is going to be our value system. Not just one person. It was one of the great lies in our culture. You have the right to define what faithfulness looks like. No, you really don't. There's a covenant with the people of God called the church. We don't get to define what that covenant looks like. There's an established order, and I hope that you don't think this is a big stick, but I feel a great burden to manage and set that up. I feel a great burden to be responsible for you and your development and establishing systems and helping you be successful and empower you to do things. I am not sure how often that sense of, wow, I am committed to this. I see this as a covenant. That's my covenant. I've made that covenant. That's my promise. I've made it publicly many times. I covenant that. Have you covenanted back to say God has positioned this little family to represent something to our little corner of this great big planet? And I'm not free to just offer whatever sacrifice I want. I'm not free to just define whatever. I'm accountable to this family. That's kind of the big idea here, mapping it over into the New Testament. Because fundamentally what's rooted in their choices was, I get to do what I want irrespective of this covenant, the covenant people of God. My choice doesn't have an impact. God says, oh, yes, it does. Yes, your choices matter. Not just to you, but to the experience of those he's put you with and to the kingdom of God at large. Verse 15, didn't the Lord make you one with your wife in body and spirit? You are his. And what does he want? Godly children from your union. So guard your heart. Remain loyal to the wife of your youth. He wants godly children. Now we can read that and think God wants children. And we can read Psalm 127 and blessed are the fruit how blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. You know, those ideas. That means God wants lots of children. Maybe he doesn't. Maybe he doesn't. I'm sure there's a blessing in that, and that's a matter of conviction. I just don't want us to miss the modifier for children. I don't know if I can speak to God's intention for how many children based on a modern culture. And what is required of parents to be away and the pressures. I don't know if I can speak. Yeah, this is a good idea for everybody to have as many children as you can. I don't know if I can say that. Certainly wouldn't direct that or be authoritative in it. It's a great choice if that's your faith. We had as many children as we could. That was our conviction. I don't know if I can impose that on everybody. But what we can't lose sight of is the modifier. Lots of children who are not godly does not satisfy God's intention for marriage. And when we try to hand, because of our, going back to the Paul Tripp thing, when we have a different standard of what godly or quality or successful or adequate kids is than godly, we have to reevaluate. How are we really investing in those kids? How are we really, what's the standard? Is youth soccer or swimming or whatever it is the issue? Or is them seeing me be godly, me walking them into helping them put that's the fundamental thing, is we transition them from pre-adolescent to adults and we release them into this world. Our job is to help them kill their flesh. Make the choice to kill their flesh. When they're younger than that, we just kill their flesh. We don't ask permission. But during that journey, we're going to help you process this, and this is what it looks like to be a man or woman of God. And here's my value system. Here's how I'm living them out. Chris and I were just really amazed. We were sitting talking with a brother, and I just stopped and paused. It's not a huge, stark difference. But the quality of marriage and conversation and progress and even the kids, because I'm here at Yoko. I see what's going on, and I'm so encouraged. I am so encouraged as people are starting to walk by faith. But I could draw a correlation between the men who are here on Thursday and the fruit that's flowing out of their kids. I could draw that pretty clearly. There's a godliness, there's a power that flows into our children when we're living a godly life. It's significant. It is significant. And what does he want? Godly children from union. So guard your hearts. Heart from what? Well, these distractions. In this context, it's, you know, not being faithful to a wife, loving something more, not valuing what God says is valuable. The whole Genesis mandate, for those of you who've been through that, that's what God says is important. This is the person you bring ultimate good to. Guard your heart. Repeat of Proverbs 4:23. Guard your heart. Out of it flow the wellsprings of life. Guard your heart. That's where the seeds come in and choke out. That's where the hurts that don't get resolved. That's where the conflict that creates distance between this covenant people all occurs. It's in our heart. We have to actively guard it. You try to passively guard your heart, there's going to be stuff that creeps in there that will change and shape your behavior, and you won't be happy long term with the fruit. For I hate divorce. I hate divorce because it's a contract. It's a covenant. It's something mystical that has happened. And I think I know most of your stories in the room, and I don't think there's a lot of divorce represented here, but there may be that I'm not aware of. And there's a grace over it, but we must understand there is a deep, deep, deep offense to God when we say this covenant is small. It's not a big thing. My affection, guarding my heart, is a small thing, and that's where even divorce starts, is in the heart. I think personally we're going to see more. Because the church, the people of God, aren't very good at guarding their heart. And the culture no longer helps produce a character that lets them endure. Now, farming community in Iowa, we don't even like each other. But we're staying married. And we're not going to see that anymore. We're not going to see each other anymore. See that kind of that character and stamina. And I don't think it has to be that way. But that's the value system. That is the value system. And in the church, the divorce rate is worse than atheists, according to Barna. He hates it. How much clearer can the heart of God be? Was it just because it's, you know, like, oh, that just bugs me? Or does it just violate his very person? Because marriage and oneness in the church, both of those contexts are this picture of the person of God, the relational nature of God. You're violating your image-bearing right to reflect the person, nature, and character of God to each other when we say this is a small thing. There's grace. And yet, we have to understand there is a kingdom cost to it. To divorce your wife is to overwhelm her with cruelty. Now, obviously, there's some cultural things there that may not be quite as true, because they really didn't have the economic rights, didn't have, you know, financial ability to support themselves. There was legal consequences. They were not separate in terms of voting, or, you know, having that voice. That was the nature of male and female at that time, is the patriarchal system and how it was lived out. You were at risk. Or when John went to Pakistan after the earthquake, he had to walk by some families where the mom was sitting there huddled with their kids, and it was approaching winter, and they were there building shelter right after this devastating earthquake. Maybe 250,000 people died, I don't remember exactly. And I remember his report when he came back. And this was the culture there. It's the culture there now. You know, they'd be going, can you build me a house? And there were guys around them with submachine guns going, no, you will build a house here. And you'll build a house here. He goes, Dad, I know unless some man takes them in, they will not make it through the winter. They have no opportunity to go get a job, go find shelter, something else. And it was just a really, really heavy thing for him. And they finally just said, I don't care if you have a machine gun, we're building them a house right here. And they let them. But that's the state, and that was the world that there was no rights. It remains true that the most effective way to put yourself in poverty, especially if you're a woman, but it's one of the laws of economic prosperity is stay married to the same woman. It's job one. Just to have financial stability. But for a woman, the stats are cruel for women who are raising kids by themselves. It's just cruel. Incredible poverty. Incredible hardship. So even today in our culture, with all the opportunities, it is still the number one reason women end up in poverty is because of divorce. So guard your heart. Again, with guard your heart. Do not be unfaithful to your wife. You are worried. You have wearied the Lord with words. How have we wearied him? What have we done? It's this attitude. We talked about it, and this is significant because anytime the scriptures repeat something, it's a theological indicator that it may be significant, okay? Whether it's in a sentence, holy, 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 or very, very, or any kind of modifier is repeated, that's the literary device being used there is emphasis. They didn't put exclamation points and happy faces like we do to show emphasis. They repeated things. They didn't have the bold font type. So they repeat it. And he's repeating this idea again. Look, you are fools. You are so wearisome. Do you really, after all that I have done for you as a nation, after all I have promised to do, you still think it doesn't matter? You think there is no difference between the good and evil? Do you think I'm an idiot? Do you think I'm blind? Do you think I can't execute what I need to execute to fulfill my plan? And we can all get in that headspace. God's forgotten me. God is not good. Boy, he's blessing those people. Maybe they have a better idea. Maybe I should pursue them. Oh, that family looks like they're doing well. And they're not doing this or that. Or they're not in a covenant. They're just living in Ogden. Said it many times. I'll keep saying it. I am so glad to be older. Because I know the end of the story of most of those things. I've watched them. I've watched those choices bear fruit over 30 years. And I look forward to the next 20 years. I don't know how much longer I want to live than that, but 20 more years of perspective and seeing those stories. I was talking to Yoko the other night. I mean, just the way they are. I've got 30 years of watching teenagers grow up into adulthood, and I could point every one of you kids, every one of your teens, to somebody that's a 30-year-old version of you, unless God does something, or because God is doing something. It goes both directions. I can introduce you to somebody. You can be Facebook friends with somebody who is living and acting and thinking like you are right now as a 30 or 35-year-old. It might be helpful for you. Because I know a lot of 30, 35-year-olds that I watched go through the very phase of life you're going through. And I see the fruit, short-term, long-term, of the choices they made. God is not stupid. God is not inactive. God is not powerless. Sometimes our flesh and our circumstances really want us to believe that so that it justifies us taking back control, violating the covenant of God's people. It's an easier, safer place somehow in our minds because this really feels true. God says, don't be a fool. This is not true. And so we press. And the culture is changing, for sure. There's things we will experience as the people of God. Even how we may lose the freedom to just even gather. I'm fairly certain right now is a great benefit. One of the great blessings of having this building, we don't pay property tax on it. I'm not sure that's going to last very long. Which means a whole bunch of churches are going to lose their buildings. Because this kind of property is really expensive in property taxes. I don't think that's going to be maintained unless we toe the politically correct line. I don't know what we're going to face, but I know I want to face it with you. I want to face it with in covenant with you. I want to stick together. I want to huddle up and go, we will honor the covenant of God that he has made with his people. And that's my hope. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for just your warnings. I don't know how to walk through this just clear and open and transparent picture that you give us of how it feels, these strong warnings, and walk away with anything other than conviction. Oh, you are big. You are huge. You are good. Your word is true. I can trust it. God, resolve my delusion. Help me, God, not to walk in the lies that I believe. God, I want to think like you, I want to live like you, and I want us to be accurate image bearers to the world around us and to one another of what you're really like. Help us in that. In Jesus' name, amen.